Hello, my name's Jamie Gordon.
And I'm Ginny Carlin.
And welcome to the BFBS podcast, Mav Geeks, a military aircraft obsession.
Now, if you've never joined us before and you're looking for deep political insights with Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, can I suggest the Rest is Politics USA podcast?
However, if you're looking for two absolute Mav Geeks who love nerding out about military aircraft by listening to the experts, then you're defo in the right place.
So, no politics, and just to be clear, we are loving the dogs, we are loving the cats, we are loving the pets of all the people that listen to Mav Geeks.
You've been tangoed, Chinster. That is a bit scary. Now listen, tell me about your aviation week.
Do you know what? I have had no aviation on the prairie at all this week. But what I thought I would do is just have a look to something from this week, the 5th of November, 1911, which I'm glad to say neither of us can remember. But did you know that it was the first recorded transcontinental flight when Calbraith Perry Rogers, which is a great name, great guy, landed at Tournament Park, Pasadena, in front of a crowd of 20,000. Spectators. Now, let me just give you a bit of a background on this guy. We'll call him Cal Rogers. He'd been taught to fly by this bloke. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, Orville Wright, Jamie.
Yeah, it rings a vague bell, actually, yeah.
Something to do with planes. But anyway, he took this aircraft. It looks like it's held together by bits of string and stuff. It looks like two penny farthings put together. And in October 1910, a newspaper publisher offered a prize of $50,000 to anyone who flew an airplane across the North American continent in 30 days or less. And the prize offer would expire on the 11th of October 1911. Well, Rogers bought a Wright Model X from the Wright brothers, like, you know, proper old Dell boy. You know, here you go, son. It's only done like 30,000 miles, whatever. And got sponsored by a soft drink called Van Fizz, which makes me laugh. And he named his airplane after the soft drink. He didn't make it in time, though. So he didn't make himself that $50,000. But completely put himself into the annals of history, crashed, was quite seriously injured, took a month off to recover, then got back in the plane and started flying again.
But these people just seem to have no fear whatsoever because, I mean, given that flying had literally just been invented, to the idea of actually going effectively, 3,000 miles across North America in something that's made of tissue paper, it's really not something that that I would be keen to do.
I know. And the thing is, he sat there, the picture of him, he sat there, he's looking like immaculately turned out with his like Peaky Blinders hat on and a massive cigar in his mouth. He's looking like he's giving, you know, zero chuffs about anything and he's just going to do it. So what an absolute legend.
Well, thank you for marking that this day in history. Today's podcast is a very special one for you, isn't it, Jinster?
It really is, Jamie. And I feel quite privileged to be able to talk about this today. So back in the 90s, I was living in Colchester, doing a job down there for the local Methodist church, unbelievably. And on a Wednesday, I had the day off and I decided one day to take a drive. My dad had told me about this place, up to the 100th Bomb Group Memorial Museum at a place called Thorpe Abbotts in Suffolk. As soon as I walked in there, I was made really, really welcome by the rest of the volunteers. So every Wednesday for that year, I would go and become a volunteer. The stories are just incredible. The 100th Bomb Group had so many losses that they were known as the Bloody 100th. And sometimes they struggled to fly in a box formation, which meant some of their bombers got picked off quite easily. But the bravery of the men, the sadness of the stories, it just got me completely. So I went back this summer to that memorial museum. And of course, it's got a little bit more famous because of the Apple TV series, Masters of the Air, which is based around the 100th Bomb Group. And so all those characters, all those people that I learnt about all those years ago that kind of me and my dad have talked about for years that in some ways I've kind of grown up with have been brought to life through that Masters of the Air programme. And it was just so great to go back again.
Because I managed to catch up with the whole series earlier on this year. And what struck me was, A, you could tell sort of Tom Hanks and Spielberg had something to do with it because it felt so real. They'd recreated everything to perfection, in my opinion. But it also just hammered home the futility of sometimes of what they were doing, because the Americans, for some reason, well, there is a perfectly good reason, they always flew in the daytime, didn't they? Mm. Whereas we Brits, we bombed at night because that was our preference, presumably because we thought it was safer. But like you say, they took so many casualties. But it really is an incredible story. And I'm so pleased that there's that personal connection with a story that's now been brought to life for so many others. So let's just have a listen. Here you are, Jenny, talking to Reg Wilson, chairman of the 100th Bomb Group Memorial Museum. And here he is giving us a history of the tower and of the 100th Bomb Group.
I'm Reg Wilson. I'm the chair of the trustees and deputy curator.
Now, I feel like I already know the answer to this, being a AV geek and being somebody that's kind of worked here myself a little bit as a volunteer. But what drew you to this place?
I don't know. It was the atmosphere. I was interested in military history and decided as I approached retirement that I wanted to get involved with some of the history locally, and I came here and a few other places, but it was something about this place that spoke to me, and so I volunteered and got hooked.
And when you say it was something that spoke to you, what can you kind of put that into words?
Not really. It's just something to do with the atmosphere. It's a feeling. It's a feeling you get, I still get, when you come into the museum in the morning or you're in late afternoon and you're on top of the tower and you look out across the airfield, which is pretty much the way it was in 1943. It's just something that you can't explain. It just speaks to you. And, you know, you have other volunteers who start to hear the same thing. You come here and there's just something about the atmosphere, about the place. You can feel it. You can feel how it was.
Obviously, there's a long and storied history to here at Thorpe Abbotts. Can you give me like a little potted version for people that don't know anything about the place?
Thorpe Abbotts Airfield was home to the 100th Bomb Group, and they were active between June 1943 and April 1945. They were one of about 40-odd heavy bomber bases that the Americans had in East Anglia in World War II. Thorpe Abbotts and the 100th Bomb Group were distinguished, if you like, by the fact that they became known as the Bloody 100th. And that was due to the terrible losses that they had on some of their missions, particularly in 1943. So they gained a reputation through that period, which they never managed to cast off, that they were a bad luck unit. And an assignment to the Bloody 100th was an assignment to death. And so the 100th Bomb Group left here in December 45. The airfield was handed back to the RAF and fell into disrepair. And then in the 70s, Mike Harvey came to the airfield and decided that something had to be done to preserve the airfield. Places like this were rapidly deteriorating. And so he and a number of volunteers, including Ron Batley, who was a volunteer back in those days and is still here now as the curator, they got a team together, and from scratch, they basically restored the tower, and then gradually over the years created the museum to the point where it was fully opened, including the visitor centre in 1986. And through that time, they had several visits from veterans who were obviously still alive in larger numbers than they are now. And that's really the way it's been since that time. The museum has expanded. It's expanded its collection. And then it was decided that they were then going to do the Masters of the Air miniseries about the 100th, which was good from our point of view, because the museum, as it's constituted now, it's a memorial museum. We aim to educate, but we're also here to remember what the guys in the 100th did when they were here. And so Masters of the Air, by telling the world and showing the world what the 100th did, is helping us to deliver what we're here to do. It's created problems for us because we are seeing visitors in much larger numbers now than we've ever done before. So our volunteers are working considerably harder than in previous years. But it's been really good for us. It's really stimulated a lot of interest in the 100th. Now, we're going to be in a position over the next year or two to see a further expansion of the museum. We have plans for doing that. And it is good to see that through Masters of the Air, the profile of visitors has changed as well. So we are seeing more families. We are seeing more younger people. So it's a really good opportunity to tell them about the 100th, but also to educate people about Second World War in general and the 8th Air Force in particular.
I'm really pleased you brought up Masters of the Air, because I was wanting to ask you about that. For you, working here at Thorpe Abbotts, was it almost a feeling of, we have been banging this drum for a long time to get these people recognised and finally it's happened?
Partially. I mean, we were very pleased. We were pleased that names like Cleve and Egan, Rosenthal, have become known to a much wider audience. But what we're trying to do with the museum is obviously, when people come along and they want to find out about the real Cleven or the real Rosenthal, we can do that. But also, I think it's also make a point not to focus just on the big names that were in Masters of the Air, because we lost 757 guys killed from here. And most of those guys were around about 20. So we don't want to, by promoting one or two names, overlook the big sacrifice that took place here. So, yes, we have exhibits for Cleven, we have exhibits for Rosenthal, but we also have exhibits for as many of these guys as we possibly can. And the way that our philosophy on the museum works is, rather than just having exhibits, is to make sure that there are stories associated with those exhibits, so you can read a little bit about the personalities, about these young men that were killed in action. So that's really what we're trying to do, and how we can use the Masters of the Air to tell that story. And you know, to point out to people that over the course of the war, there were 26,000 casualties flying from the air bases across East Anglia. So it's not just Rosie and Cleven here. What happened to the 100th Bomb Group represents what happened to all the bomb groups. They all had similar experiences to the 100th Bomb Group.
Do you know what really gets me about those volunteers, about the people there? You can hear it with the way that Reg speaks. All they are interested in is preserving the memory of the men that flew from there, because of the sadness, because like you say, the futility, the number of men that died, that gave their life, the ultimate sacrifice. It is truly humbling.
What was it like for you going back after so long this summer?
Well, I mean, it's probably, is it 30 years? It was the 90s. It was great because it was such a beautiful day, and it's somewhere that's really special to me because, like, me and my dad talk about it a lot, and, you know, we've almost a family connection with it. But I made some really good friends when I was there back in the 90s. I was a slip of a girl, and just finding out about the characters, about the people that had flown, some of them who had been back to visit the tower as well in the 90s. I mean, obviously, many of them are over 100 now. It was amazing. And to see that legacy being carried on by people who love the 100th Bomb Group, love the tower, love the stories, you know, it gets me every time, Jamie.
And of course, I imagine it's a very atmospheric place, Trini.
It really is, and it's in the middle of deepest, darkest Suffolk, which in the middle of summer is absolutely beautiful. But you've got to imagine what it must have been like for those airmen in the desolation of the winter. It is very atmospheric. There's lots of stories abound. One of the things for me when I was there in the 90s was that feeling of never quite being alone there, as though we were being watched. It was a very atmospheric place.
Well, we had Mav Shreeks last week, but here you are talking about some of the more ghostly going on in the tower.
Now, something you said a little bit earlier, Reg, I don't believe in ghosts, but I imagine there's plenty that do here.
Yeah.
Believe in ghosts.
Yes.
And so you've never seen anything that you would, has made your hair stand on end, maybe?
I have worked in the tower a lot, all year round, day and night, nothing. I don't feel that kind, I don't feel that sort of activity at all. Besides, you know, my view would be, even if they were here and they really did exist, you know, why are they going to interfere with me? All I'm trying to do is help preserve their memories. So.
There was a few things happened when I was here.
Yeah.
To people, the people and feelings and.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I know. Some people have explained. Some volunteers have said that they've seen things or felt things, but not for me.
Because I know that somebody I used to volunteer with here years ago was telling me about the time when he'd locked up the tower. As he was walking away, somebody waved to him from inside the tower, and he thought, oh no, I've locked somebody in. Came back and went for a good look round, and he said to me, the only way I can describe it, Ginny, is that the walls were vibrating when I went in. And I know exactly what he meant, because that happened to me once before as well. And he used to be a military policeman, and he said, I took some long strides very quickly round to make sure nobody was in, and then I got out of there as quickly as I could. And some of the veterans came back, and you mentioned it's one of the veterans, and they said, oh, yeah, we used to see that all the time.
I've not seen it. I've not
heard Ernie, they called it.
I haven't actually heard it since I've been here. You've been here long, haven't you? Have you had any unusual experiences?
Well, you probably explain what I felt a presence once
I was up here, and I started to speak to someone. I thought there was someone standing there, and I looked, and there was nobody there. I thought, did I imagine that? But that could perhaps be explained. And there was another one downstairs. I was in the Varian in a room, and suddenly the door handle dropped. I went and tried it. It was all right. Well, that perhaps could be explained. But...
that's been explained by the poor maintenance.
Yeah. Because we've had the stories about people could smell cigarette smoke, American cigarette smoke up here. Well, I haven't.
Another thing that was here when I was here, where that two of the people that were here volunteering were sort of painting and doing bits. One of them's wife brought them a cup of tea, and as soon as she walked in, it was as though it was just hailing on the roof. And one of them shouts, "It's all right, she's with us," and it just stopped. That's a weird one. I don't know.
I remain open-minded, yes, to be convinced.
Do you know, it's really funny because, you know, we talked about Mav Shrieks last week and we had a bit of fun with that. But the whole ghost thing, I think, at Thorpe Abbotts is not sensationalised at all. I mean, you heard Reg saying that he'd never had any experiences, but it's all done with a great amount of respect, which I absolutely love. But you cannot deny that there's a feeling over the place, you know, a good feeling, but also quite a sad feeling.
That really comes across. It does. But the next bit here, we're going to listen to Reg talking to you about some of the exhibits, and there must be some absolute treasures in there.
Oh my gosh, yeah. And some of the stuff that I remembered as well from the 90s, and of course it's been kind of really jacked up now into the 2000s, and everything just looks so much bigger, so much brighter, but there's still this brilliant display of all the leather jackets that the pilots wore that they had painted up. And a lot of the families have dedicated them to the 100th Bomb Group and brought them in. So they're there behind the glass and they just look fantastic.
So, you know, Rosie is one of the guys featured in Masters of the Air, and quite rightly. His first three missions included two of the worst missions that they had in 1943. And on that 10th of October 1943 mission, he's the only guy to come back.
Gosh.
12 aircraft shot down, and he's coming back on two engines. And then he goes on to do 52 missions with the 100th, and shot down twice behind Russian lines on one occasion, as kind of shown in Masters of the Air. Completes his tours and then becomes an assistant prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials and gets an opportunity to interview Goering. So, you know, it's a fantastic story. We were so lucky that we have his uniform, we have his medals here.
And just as I'm reading on here, a regular visitor back...
He was, yes. I never got a chance to meet him, but I think he was a regular visitor, a great supporter of the museum, and hence the stuff that he's donated to us here, particularly, you know, with his medal collection, which is... You know,
extensive.
Very extensive.
Yeah.
Exceptional guy.
There's a picture up as well here. A brilliant likeness to him as well on that picture, isn't it? It's really well done in front of the B-17 Roses riveters, which just about sums it all up, really, doesn't it? It's a lovely picture.
So I've been also fortunate enough to recently talk to Dan Rosenthal, his son, and, you know, so how you think they portrayed Rosie in Masters of the Air, and Dan really feels that they captured the personality of Rosie. He was quiet, unassuming, but determined to get the job done. And that's what he did.
Because a lot of people were saying, well, they don't look anything like them, but it's more than that, isn't it? It's like an essence of that person.
Yeah, I think the person, I mean, Rosie, you know, in Masters of the Air, okay, he's got a moustache, he doesn't have a moustache in real life, but again, for the purpose of the movie, they've got to be able to distinguish guys from each other and try and make it a bit different. But I think in terms of the personality, his outlook and his attitude to what he was being asked to do, I think that was pretty spot on.
Brilliant. What else have we got?
Various displays from individuals, again, you know, so we were lucky to have little collections of things left by ground crew, ground staff.
That's really poignant, isn't it? So Lieutenant Clifford Milburn and a picture of his sweetheart, I guess.
Yeah.
Wow, and the medal.
Yeah, we are fortunate with some of the medals we've got. But then also we have this souvenir case here. So there are pictures of John Egan wearing a fez on the Regensburg-Schweinfurt mission, which is again portrayed in Masters of the Air. They landed in North Africa, and quite a lot of them brought back souvenirs. So you've got
the fezes. Yeah.
They must have been buying fezes in large numbers, the knives and things. And then, of course, the ultimate souvenir that they brought back, displayed on here, which is
the donkey.
Oh, the donkey, yeah. brought back, but we weren't the only airbase to bring back a donkey from North Africa, but poor Mo didn't last very long. I think the English weather didn't suit it.
This is kind of Masters of the Air style stuff, really, looking at it, isn't it? You can imagine it on the programme. Look at this, Glenn Miller, gosh. And there he is with his band in the hand.
I think that's the Century Bombers band. So that's that's the airbase band, yeah. Century Bombers. And then at the top there, you know, they've got the celebrations that they have with a fanfare, and they would have parties and at Christmas parties, get the local kids in and give them ice cream and stuff like that.
Must be weird being quite an unassuming museum for years that you've done as a memorial for these people, for the 8th Air Force, like you say, and then suddenly people are coming here expecting to see, but of course it wasn't filmed here, was it? It was filmed at Abingdon.
No, there was no filming down here at all. There was some consultation by some of the trustees with filmmakers, and they came up here and they did do measurements of various things. What was amazing was that some of us got to go down and have a look at the set.
Oh, wow.
And the attention to detail was phenomenal. So when you went into some of the rooms, some of the offices, you know, yeah, not only was the furniture right, but if you looked at the filing tray, and there were papers in the filing tray, they were exact replicas of a genuine document. The whole pile was a reproduction of an original document. So, you know, even though you're not going to see that detail on the screen, it was there. And it was very emotional, because I think when we stepped into an operations block, you could have been stepping back in time. It was surreal. It was a fantastic, fantastic job they did with some of that. Absolutely great.
This final part from the tower is incredibly sad in parts, isn't it, Jenny?
It really is. And like I was saying earlier, I think that this is the reason why a lot of the volunteers are so absolutely drawn to help out Thorpe Abbotts, because when you think of some of the things that happened, I mean, you heard me talking about the aircraft that crashed on their final mission. I mean, just, you know, it gives me a lump in my throat even just thinking about it. And I think that's why people are so drawn to Thorpe Abbotts. They're so drawn to preserving that memory and time in history when there was so much loss. And I think as well, Tom Hanks, you were talking about him earlier on, making Masters of the Air. I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, he did Blood Brothers and paid an excellent homage to the guys on the ground. But he wanted to do this, and I can absolutely see why he did it. And it's so, so good that people are now actually seeing what happened, not just with the 100th Bomb Group, but with the USAF, with the RAF, and the sacrifices that were made. And I mean, it just looks amazing on the screen, but at the heart of it, there's some really sad and really life-affirming stories too.
And I was going to say, what the programme certainly doesn't do is pull any punches. I mean, it's pretty graphic in what it portrays in terms of the way people died. I mean, the stats themselves are just horrible, because, for example, a waste gunner in a B-17, how was life for them? Well, frankly, it was not very good. The mortality rates for US bomber crews were 20%. That's 50 times the US European infantry, and 10 times that of the US Pacific infantry. And the rates of injury and capture, they were also higher among the bomber crews compared to any other military service at the time. Anyway, let's just go back and hear a bit more of the conversation between you and Reg.
One is fairly plain A2 jacket from a guy called Jack Graziano. Got his record here. He was actually in the army before he joined the Air Force, so he had a sort of like double service. He was a friend of the actor Robert Duvall.
Oh, wow.
And this jacket was worn by Robert Duvall in a movie, with a picture there, called Badge 373. So we got a picture of Robert Duvall wearing that very jacket that Jack Graziano wore, so that's quite a... Somebody said that at the end of the movie, he ends up in the river, I think in a jacket, whether it was this one or not, I don't know. But
can't even think about that, can you? This jacket getting wet, gosh.
Yeah, so that's had quite a history, because it's survived the war, and then it's been in a movie. The other little display that we have here is what I said earlier, you know, that a lot of aircraft were lost to accidents. And this is an example of one of those aircraft, Captain Crow, and the crew of the Wright Raper crew. So this was one that was forming up on a mission. The mission of their day was going to be Berlin. So they knew that they were in for a pretty rough ride. It was likely to be a long and dangerous mission. But they only got across to the East Coast to towards Lowestoft when there was an accident with a flare that went off inside the aircraft and set fire to the flares, the other flares. So immediately the aircraft fills up with smoke and they lose control and they crash, you know, near to Ashby Church, which is over near Herringfleet, near Herringfleet Hall. So the two of them are killed in that crash, largely the crew towards the front of the aircraft, near a site where two other aircraft, in fact, crashed into Fritton Lake from the 56th Fire Group. The bombs from the aircraft crash through the kitchen wall, I think, of Herringfleet Hall, but don't go off. So it just shows you how just dangerous it was flying. Accidents, you know. Those guys, they weren't taken by flak, they weren't taken by fighters, but gave their lives in pursuit of their mission in the same way that everyone else did. But I think it's just quite a sad story, particularly since there's letters from Jack Raper home that were sent very, very close to that mission, and you wonder whether those letters got there before the telegram.
Oh, gosh, that doesn't bear thinking about, does it?
You know.
I know my dad was saying to me the other day, I think he said it was happened here, but you'll be able to tell me. Two B-17s that were coming in and they got to the end of their missions, and I think some of the guys sort of had a cigar and on board, and they clipped each other, and that was the end of
I didn't know about
everything.
That.
Right.
Was that from here?
I've heard that as well.
But, you know, these guys were having like a little glass of champagne, you know, the end of our time, got through it all safely and just about home, and they clipped and every man on board, both of them, were died. It's just the incredible sadness of that. Still keep in touch with the families of these veterans, because obviously these veterans...
Yeah, some of them.
With
some
age
them,
or...
Yes, you know, Dan Rosenthal, who's on the 100th Bomb Group Foundation board. We're in touch with him quite a lot, and other members of the foundation are family members. The museum is always open for families. So if a family comes across and they want to come on a Thursday or Friday or any day we're closed, we're always open for families, and families will always be given a special treatment when they come here. We are usually able to take the families out onto the airfield with the permission of the landowner. Sometimes we can take them back to the exact spot where Dad or Granddad was billeted, or where he would have, you know, where he would have eaten, or where his hard stand was. And that can be very, you know, very emotional. And as I said, because of that trauma and some people not wanting to talk about their experience, sometimes the families have to come here to find out actually what happened.
Do you feel a little bit like, I mean, obviously, the majority of these people you'll have never met, but do you feel a little bit like you kind of know them in a way?
Yes, you do. You do, but, you know, because I haven't really met any of them, veterans, as they are now, they're kind of like frozen like this with me. They're these young guys. I see them as these young guys. And, of course, most of them never got past beyond being young guys. Yeah. So, yeah, you do kind of know them. You know, you all have your respect for all of them, but you all have, you know, you have your favourites and...
I guess the people whose stories resonate.
Saying I don't believe in ghosts, and I do not believe in ghosts, I still find myself talking to the guys in the tower.
Do you?
Yes. It's weird.
One day they'll talk back.
Yeah, okay, we can try that.
Yeah, just before we get into the final clip with the stars of Masters of the Air, I think it's really good to hear how the museum have embraced all this extra publicity and they're using it to further the story and therefore further honouring the memory of those brave boys.
Absolutely, Jamie. And I mean, none of it was actually filmed at Thorpe Abbotts. I believe it was filmed around Abingdon, the airfield there, and around Oxfordshire. But one of the things that Reg really spoke to me about was they'd made a pledge not to compare, you know, tit for tat. Well, this wasn't right. I mean, he does say that actually they've got a lot of it absolutely right. But, you know, there was a few little bits which weren't exactly the same. He was like, we're not going to compare it. We're just going to take it for what it is. And we're just going to be grateful that it's been used to really take our story forward and the story of the, like you say, these brave young men. So I thought that was a really great thing from Reg.
And we couldn't talk about Masters of the Air and not end with this. BFBS's Natasha Renault, an honorary Mav Geek for this week, she got the chance to talk to the two stars of the show, aka Major Buck Egan and Major Buck Cleven.
Now, Austin, the last time that you and I spoke, it was for Elvis, where you were method acting for the role. And I understand for Masters of the Air, the cast were put on a boot camp with a veteran turned military advisor. So what did you have to do as part of that training?
Well, I mean, first of all, I was maybe the most starstruck I've ever been by Captain Dale Dye. Because since I was a kid, I'd watched behind the scenes on Platoon or Saving Private Ryan or any of these films. And Dale Dye was always the guy that right. you know, took all the actors to boot camp. And so and was in a way sort of the inspiration for Tropic Thunder, you know. So I was very starstruck by Dale Dye.
That's amazing.
And
the BTS stuff.
Yeah, the BTS.
Oh, I've never seen that.
And yeah, you gotta watch like the Saving Private Ryan one's amazing. But he, for us, it was educating us on that time period. There was a portion where we were sort of in a classroom all together. Mm-hmm. It was, it was really from the ground up. It was how to march, how to salute, how to work an aircraft. So we had part of that was our time in the cockpit, learning every switch and knob and. How to take off and all the protocols and everything. It was the physical, you know, we went on some runs and
what was that? We did that push-up. When was that push-up again?
Yeah, it was, what do they call it? Where each of us had our feet on the guy's shoulders behind us and we did a push-up all together.
Like 100 people.
Yeah.
The one-ton push-up, was it cool?
Yeah, the one-ton push-up. One-ton push-up.
It sounds
where all
like
of
it would
us
be
pushing up.
Amazing. Yeah, because
if one person doesn't do it,
it doesn't work.
It throws it all off. And
it was about, there was this thing called crew glue. That was the thing that we were building. All the things Austin said, but we were building this bond and this unity and this togetherness that we then used to propel ourselves through the next 10 months.
Mm-hmm. And Callum, what did you think of the flight simulators? Because we've done it at BFBS and it's very realistic and a little bit scary.
Oh, you use the volume?
Yes.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, it's a gift as an actor because you're seeing everything happen around you. You're also on a gimbal 50 foot up in the air, which is, you know, if you're going down, it goes like that. If flak hits, it shakes. So you don't even have to think about playing something. It just happens. And you're just trying to stay as cool as possible. Mm-hmm. I loved it in there. The only difficult thing about it was that because it was so difficult to get up, get the gimbal down for you to get up, we'd be in there for like 6 hours, mm-hmm. 7 hours at a time, which was a bit of a slog.
In the summertime, that got really hot. You're in your shearling jacket and you're 50 feet in the air and heat rises and it gets very hot in there.
And there's screens, you know, 360, a sphere of screens around you, so it's like...
Yeah, so all the lights are really hot as well. And
I felt like I got jet lag in there a little bit, you know?
Yeah, it's wild.
It was like we're on a long flight.
Yeah, yeah.
With no movies to watch.
Yeah, you could see people start to panic.
You know, I did, towards the end, I started to DJ, so the sound gave me the room.
Did that?
Yeah. So
what would you DJ, off your phone?
Off my phone, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Bluetooth?
Bluetooth, man.
Yeah. How about that? I didn't get that kind technology. Of privilege.
See, they didn't tell you about it?
No, they didn't tell me about that.
All the things that you can do.
We don't fly together, man.
I know.
But the characters you play, they were real people. So what acts of Buck and Bucky's real-life heroism impacted you the most?
You know, I think we were just touching on this. The fact that both of them joined before Pearl Harbor. They weren't forced into the military at all. They were the type of people who really were focused on what was right and what was good and protecting their country and protecting values in the world and they were strong, you know, honorable men. So I feel privileged that we got to bring their story to life.
And they were the best pilots too.
Yeah, yeah,
they were. That's true. Until Rosenthal, I think they were seen as the best pilots in the Air Corps.
Yeah, so everybody looked up to them, and they really set a standard.
Absolutely.
Well, Callum, Austin, thank you both so much for joining us on BFBS, the Forces Station. It's been a pleasure chatting to you about Masters of the Air.
That's just about it for this week. I just want to say a really quick thank you, Jamie, for letting me share a little bit about a place and people that are really special to me and the volunteers who, for all these years, have kept the 100th Bomb Group Museum going and the memory of those young men and people like a guy called Mike Harvey, who saw the old control tower back in the 70s and wanted to get it done up and made into a proper memory and a museum and a tribute for all those that had died. It's really special to me.
Well, it's been a real education and a privilege to hear what you've had to say about something that's clearly so important to you. So join us next week as we've looked around Ginny's old stomping ground. This week, we are going to look at your present day stomping ground, if there is such a phrase. Anyway, we're celebrating the Royal Canadian Air Force's centennial.
Yeah, I'm really, really looking forward to bringing you this. There's some stuff from Riat. There's some stuff from Lieutenant General Kenny, who is the head of the Royal Canadian Air Force. And, you know, you get to have a little look around where I live, kind of, anyway.
And, of course, you can catch up with Maverick Geeks on air 6 till 7 on Tuesdays and repeated at 1 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon.
And if you want to get in touch with us with any questions or if you've got a fantastic idea for a Mav Geeks episode, please get in touch. It's just mavgeeks@bfbs.com. We'll catch you next week.
Cheers.
Ta-ra.